dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One facet of this war, which is largely neglected, I'm afraid, and certainly not been terribly competently executed where it hasn't been neglected, is in the space that involves the effort to counter insurgencies and dominate the space so that those who seek to destabilize countries or assert their will in other ways cannot succeed. A man who has firsthand experience with a successful counterinsurgency operation, who has written a very thoughtful book about the subject, and who is our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say, is Stephen Young. He is today the Global Executive Director of the Co-Roundtable for Moral Capitalism. He has previously served as an assistant dean at the Harvard Law School and is the author of three important books, Moral Capitalism, The Road to Moral Capitalism, and the one that we will be focusing on in particular today, The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, CORDS, in the Villages of Vietnam, 1967 to 1972. Steve Young, thank you so much for coming back on Secure Freedom Radio and for the chance to spend an hour with you sort of plumbing your corporate memory about a successful counterinsurgency operation, why, despite its success, the war was lost, but also the lessons for our own time of your efforts in Vietnam. So it's good to have you with us, sir.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for having me and giving me a chance to talk about that, because I hope your audience will feel as we get into the discussion that forgetting everything about Vietnam in so many ways has been tragic for our country. People just want to put bad things behind them, including our national security elite, who don't want to go back there because they think there's nothing good to learn. And then a lot of people whose memory is kind of, an anti-war movement of protest that America isn't good, that, you know, we shouldn't go to other people's countries, all of which put it together, I think, led to our inabilities in Iraq, Afghanistan, and maybe kind of our problems today in Venezuela. I mean, how do we effectively help the Venezuelan people? So I'm grateful to you for giving me a chance to share some of my ideas.
Well, again, they're not just ideas. They're informed by firsthand experience, and I think that's what makes this such an important conversation. I did want to start out by asking you to sort of set up what you mean by associative approach or associative power as a contrast to, I guess, what we've come to know and loosely discuss as hard versus soft power. What is associative power and how does it fit into that spectrum?
Well, it fits in, Frank, right in the middle. It's somewhere between hard power and soft power. The theoretical proposition which informed me, and I'll tell you kind of how I came to this, but which I use, is Clausewitz, which I think we've overlooked. I mean, the famous definition of Clausewitz back in whatever it was, 1820 or something, that war is an extension of politics by other means. What Clausewitz, I think, is pointing us to is a continuum. It's a continuum of power. And you need to be able to slide back and forth, kind of depending on where your enemy is and what you need to achieve. And if you look at that, then you got to think, well, is hard power really applicable to victory in this circumstance? Is soft power very applicable? Then what happened to me was I was bringing up a book, a manuscript I'd written I'd helped Ellsworth Bunker, our ambassador in Saigon, write years ago, and then his wife didn't want to get it published. It never got published, and I wanted to make sure that his achievements and what we did there did not just pass away. And so I got a little grant to help me buy some time to rewrite it, and the advice was, well, you know, the Vietnam War is so long ago, and people don't want to talk about it. You need to tell your story, which is relevant to contemporary national security thinking. So I said, well, what about hard power and soft power? And my first thought was, yeah, sure. I mean, successful counterinsurgency and pacification is quote-unquote soft power. But, Frank, I need to tell you that from the first time Joe Nye wrote about this, I was not persuaded. But when I'm trying to think about how do you fit the Accords pacification program into hard power and soft power, you can't do it. It's not hard power because there's a political context.
And again, hard power, as Joe Nye has conceived of it, and we usually talk about it, is basically kinetic warfare, right? It's the physical coercive use of force.
And the theory, the way we applied it, frankly, and you can get statements from this in Iraq and Afghanistan, was that if we kill all the bastards, then we win the war. The counter to that is the people who said, well, it's just a game of whack-a-mole. You kill two, they recruit four. Or you can't kill your way out of an insurgency. But then we never really got beyond and today in Afghanistan, basically it's kinetic, and it hasn't done that much good in organizing the people.
I think that's a very generous overstatement. You could argue it hasn't done any good. But Steve Young, let's just drill down for a moment on the alternative to that under, again, the Joe Nye at Harvard construct. Soft power is using an array of other instruments, but pretty much deliberately eschewing the use of force. Is that right?
Well, I read Joe Nye and thinking about it, and when I drill down on soft power, what I get is it's power in our American hands because other people are just like us, and they're going to do what we want because they think the way we do. They believe in democracy. They've all read John Locke. They believe in human rights. They, in certain contexts, you know, they want different circumstances for women, et cetera, et cetera. And because those people, wherever they are in Iraq or Afghanistan or even maybe Saudi Arabia, because, you know, or Syria today, you know, because they're like us, they're going to sacrifice their lives, their families, et cetera, to help us achieve our foreign policy objective.
Especially things like democracy and human rights and so on. In other words, that they share, if not a deep knowledge of Locke and so on, at least more or less common values, or if not even that, they are susceptible to moral suasion and reason and the argument that this is a better way than the way they have long practiced their political affairs or their culture or their lives.
Right. Hard power is, kinetic power is pretty unilateral, right? I have a gun and you don't, and I use it, and I get my way. And Clausewitz writes about that. Soft power, if you will, is also unilateral. I show up in your village or I show up in your country, and I basically say, look, I'm nicer, wiser, and smarter than you and your ancestors have been for the last 100, 2,000, whatever years, you know, so let me tell you how to do it. Oh, and by the way, that means you guys are going to have to fight these other people, and they, turns out, they're all around you. They have guns.
We have to stop for just a second, Steve. We're going to come back right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to the second segment of an hour-long conversation with Steve Young, the Global Executive Director of the Coe Roundtable for Moral Capitalism. He's written two books on that topic, Moral Capitalism and The Road to Moral Capitalism. But the book that we're really focusing on at the moment, because not only of its importance in understanding some of our important past, but very much to figuring out what we need to do for the future as we wrestle with today's adversaries, particularly those who are capable of or engaged in, for that matter, insurgencies against us and our friends and allies. Steve Young, your book, The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, explores the project in which you were personally engaged, CORDS, in the villages of Vietnam from 1967 to 1972. And I just want you to quickly, you know, describe associative power, how it contrasts with the hard and soft kind, and then explore with us what CORDS was about and how it exemplified that use of power.
Right. So, Frank, so I was thinking back and working on this manuscript. How did we win the war? How did we defeat the Viet Cong, which, by the way, we did under CORDS, and nobody sort of has picked that up, which is really stupid for our American elite. I mean, if we did win a guerrilla war, you'd think somebody would really pay attention. And what we did in CORDS was neither hard power, though we needed people with guns and they were shooting and fighting and tactical and kinetic things, nor was it soft power, because the Vietnamese people in their village were fighting for their own reasons. They were joining with us because we independently, separately, we had a common cause. Their cause was to defeat the communists in their culture, in their country, and to preserve freedom and democracy. Our cause was to sort of stop communism around the world and help people like the Vietnamese. So what CORDS really was an alliance. It was a partnership. It was an association. That's where I thought of using this word. It's associative power. You and I work together on a common agenda. And then there's some very important examples in the past. For example, how did Washington win the Battle of Yorktown in the Revolutionary War? Basically, we Americans tend to forget this. There was a French fleet in the Chesapeake Bay blocking resupply and reinforcement for Cornwallis' troops. At some point, that was associated power between the infant United States and the monarchy of France, negotiated by Benjamin Franklin. And you had people like Lafayette and others who sort of, you know, were ambassadors or liaison going back and forth. Another example, which always surprises me that people forget, is the Battle of Waterloo. You know, we brought up to believe that it was, you know, Wellington and his squares that stopped Napoleon and won the day. If you read the history of the battle, it was actually the arrival of Blücher and his Prussian army about 3:30, 4:30 in the afternoon, I think, which convinced Napoleon he couldn't win. So he stopped the fight and retreated. Now, why did Blücher show up? Because there was associative power between the British with Wellington and the Prussians, who had a common interest in working together to stop Napoleon.
But it was very much in the kinetic mode, that particular example.
Right. But then as we start digging deeper into what is associative power, how do you use it, you have to build alliances. You got to figure out why somebody else is willing to fight with you, for you, associate with you. And I think we can make the analogy to some fairly simple things like a business partnership or, frankly, even a marriage. Different parties bring different things to the table. If you can work out the balance of contributions and you have trust and you have good communications, then on your side, you've augmented your total power available, right? If I'm Wellington and I've got an alliance with Blücher, I've just basically doubled the kinetic force I have available. If my government, if they mess up the diplomacy and they don't get the Prussians to commit money and troops to this campaign against Napoleon, I'm in a very, very different situation, and I probably won't prevail. So what happened under the CORDS program in Vietnam was we worked out various ways to work with, mobilize Vietnamese villagers and on up the line through local forces, regional forces, and ultimately the ARVN stepped up, took over the main defense against the NVA regulars, the Republic of South Vietnam's army, and then our American forces could go home, and the communists had not conquered South Vietnam. And that's what happened by January 1973.
And just to make sure everybody's on the same page with us here, CORDS, C-O-R-D-S, was the acronym in the classic U.S. military mode of Civil Operations Rural Development Support. And tell us what involvement you had with this CORDS program.
Right. Well, CORDS was set up as an initiative of President Lyndon Johnson in November 1966, and this is something that the historians never really figured out, McNamara, this genius apparently with kinetic power and kill ratios and search and destroy and attrition, sends a memo to Johnson in October 66 saying, "I don't know how to win this war." Johnson then turns to Walt Rostow and Comer, two civilians, and they come up with this theory of using associative power, not unilateral American kinetic power. And a new organization, CORDS, is created. Comer, in early 67, Comer is sent over to set it up. I volunteer for service on the counterinsurgency side about that time. So when I graduate from Harvard College and show up in Washington, there's this new organization. We're sent to a training program to learn Vietnamese for 1 year. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, we never took the time. And Afghanistan's going on, how long is it now? 17 years?
Yes, sir.
And we never took the time or money to train a cadre of Americans, especially civilian, who spoke the different languages of Afghanistan, who learned something about that. And here we are 17 years later, and we still can't make it. Anyway, so I had a year of language training. Then I was sent to some districts in the Mekong Delta for about a year to advise district officials and work with village officials. And then William Colby, who later became head of the CIA, he was then head of CORDS. He pulled me up to Saigon, turned me into a bureaucrat, and gave me the mandate to improve village government across the 2,100 villages in Vietnam.
And which year was this?
This would have been 69.
So this is after the Tet Offensive. This is after the moment when we were told the war was lost by some. You were actively in the field, and you were turning things around.
The failure of the communists in the Tet Offensive so shook the South Vietnamese that they said, "We got to stand up and fight these guys." So you could go to the villages starting in mid-68, and basically you could recruit all kinds of people.
But again, this is such an important point, Steve Young, and I just want to emphasize it. The reason you could recruit people in the villages, that they would be willing to work with you in what was a hazardous business, let's be clear, you know, collaborating with the United States could very easily get you killed by the Viet Cong or the North Vietnamese if they were able to get at you. And they did it because of that associative basis for this collaborative effort, right?
They made a partnership with us. They had their reasons as Vietnamese. They had Vietnamese nationalism, which was 2,000, 3,000 years old. Communism, our elite in the anti-war movement over here totally forgot that communism came from France. It was an import from the European West. It had no roots among the Vietnamese people. So if you could give the villages power and allow them to be Buddhist, Confucian, whatever, spirit worshiper, something like that, and have their own property and their own sense of individualism, they would stand up and fight the communists in Hanoi. So all you had to do was create a partnership. Basically, we would bring some things to the table. We'd bring some money. We'd bring weapons. We'd bring technical expertise. We'd put some American advisors down there. But then we turned to them and said, "You guys got to bring something to the table. You got to bring men. You got to bring courage to stand up. You got to bring a willingness to accept casualties because your people are going to get killed by the communists.
And you've got to be prepared to fight." Steve, let me just interrupt you at one point because I don't want it to go unremarked. It wasn't just that the Vietnamese had no tradition of communism. It was that they saw it across the border in North Vietnam. They saw what was happening to people there. They saw the condition in which, in some cases, family members were being, you know, subjected to horrible repression and worse. So this was very real to them, was it not, in the CORDS program?
Absolutely. I mean, now experts will start, you know, debating whether people in the critical part of the war is the Mekong Delta, where a large majority of Vietnamese lived in villages, that they had less direct experience with North Vietnam than others, and there was ethnic regional rivalries between Southerners and Northerners. Yeah, and all of that is true. But I think, Frank, your general point is taken. By the time you get to 69, and after the Tet Offensive, where the communists attacked everywhere across Vietnam, and they attacked the cities and the towns, they didn't attack American forces to say, "We're here to drive out these, you know, these imperialistic foreigners." No, They attacked your brother, your uncle, your cousin, your somebody, the guy, you know, the kid who was in high school with you, who is now a sergeant in a regional platoon. So they go into his house and you know, they shoot him and they shoot his. It's a holiday. It's a Christmas holiday too. They shoot him. They shoot the wife. You know, you now got a nephew you got to take care of. All of a sudden, you see the reality of what communism means. It's personal.
Yeah. We just have to pause for 1 second. Stephen Young, our guest for this full hour, will return right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we have been privileged to have a full hour of the time of a busy guy. His name is Stephen Young. He has been working now for some time on advancing the cause of moral capitalism, which is a subject for a whole nother program. But we're speaking to him today about the subject of an important book that he's written on the subject of the theory and practice of associative power, cords, in the villages of Vietnam. Steve Young, we've set the stage, I think, nicely for sort of the fuller explication of what made this program that you were directly involved in and largely ran, the Civil Operations Rural Development Support, or CORDS program in Vietnam in the 67 to 72 period. Tell us those, I mentioned before the break, several characteristics of the CORDS program that were, I think you argue, instrumental in making it successful, and a cautionary tale about what we've been doing in the counterinsurgency space ever since.
Well, Frank, let me try to put it very quickly and simply. So the theory of counterinsurgency using associative power has one central point. It's the people are the front line. What you got to do is get the people to be the frontline troops against the insurgents. In order to do that, you have to stand behind the people and support them. You support them with schools, with markets, with agricultural credit, with guns, with a training for their self-defense units. And if you do that, they then basically the guerrillas evaporate, the insurgents evaporate. You're flipping Mao's proposition that the guerrillas are the fish who swim among the sea of the people on its head, and you turn it against the guerrillas.
There's no sea for them to swim in other words.
Yeah, you can't do it with hard power. Americans charging around or central government troops, as we're doing in Afghanistan, charging around looking for bad guys up in the hill and killing two or three when 15 to 20 survive. Nor can you do it with soft power as Americans showing up in a village and say, you know, fight those guys so you can be like us in Orange County. You got to have something which is more complicated. It's in the middle. It's associative power. It's bringing things to the people and making a partnership with them.
Uh-huh. And accountability as well, the metrics for making sure that that was the case and using intelligence effectively.
There were two kinds of metrics in a lot of arguments. One, there are output metrics, but more importantly are input metrics. In the beginning, the win the hearts and minds idea of pacification was input metrics. If you show up in your village and I give you 50 bags of bulgur wheat and 14 cans of cooking oil, you'll think I'm a nice American, but that ain't going to have you go out and stand guard against the Viet Cong and get, you know, assassinated on your way home. Output metrics, what we call the HESS, the Hamlet Evaluation Survey, and also the PASS, Pacification Attitude Analysis, goes in and sees what is the outcome, what are conditions in the villages like, and how do we measure them, and then that allows us to focus on outcomes. When you focus on outcomes, and outcomes get better, Oh, the other thing, Frank, is that in the CORES program, there's a major mutual relationship between security and economic development. If you get security, you get more economic development. If you get more economic development, people have a greater stake in their village communities. They're more willing to go out and fight.
They have both a stake in fighting, and they have the wherewithal to do the fighting. And they know that somebody's got their back if all else fails. They're not entirely on their own. So, Steve, you said earlier that CORDS was victorious over the Viet Cong, which were, of course, the irregular forces that were operating in South Vietnam, not to be confused with, though clearly tied to and supported by, the North Vietnamese Army. If successful, how successful was it? And if it was so successful, how come we lost the war?
Well, there's a little bit of a story there, Frank, which our people have never been told, really, which is there was, in addition to the successful pacification program in South Vietnam, there were secret negotiations between the United States and the North Vietnamese in Paris. And the secret negotiations were conducted by Henry Kissinger. And on a precise date, May 31, 1971, which was pretty early, Kissinger decided that the North Vietnamese could keep their regular forces in South Vietnam after a peace agreement. And the North Vietnamese took him up on that. So we had a peace agreement agreed to over the protest of President Thieu.
In fact, he had been excluded from the negotiations, right?
He'd been excluded from the negotiations, but on another point, he had been kept personally informed by Ellsworth Bunker, our ambassador, and Ellsworth was scrupulous in informing Thieu of everything. On this deal of May 31, 1971, Kissinger was not open with Bunker about what the deal really was. He kind of camouflaged his concession. So Bunker never told Thieu that basically the Americans were not going to stand behind him.
And presumably the reason Kissinger was not transparent about that would have been that might have caused resistance to his program, to his agenda.
Yes, and it was also counter to what President Nixon wanted.
Yeah, the stated policy.
Yeah, I kind of stumbled on this. This is a longer story. Maybe we have to talk about it later. I kind of stumbled on this by accident, and then I got to know Nixon because Kissinger's in his memoirs kind of likes to throw the, not directly, but to give you a sense that, oh, it was Nixon who really had this decent interval, you know, just get out and, you know, let the communists win a couple of years and wash our hands of all these people, 58,000 American lives who died in this war, you know. So it took me some effort, but I got to know Nixon, and I finally got up my courage to ask him, and he was dumbfounded.
This was asking him about the failure to let the Vietnamese know what he was up to.
Exactly. And Kissinger he thought it had just happened sort of at the end in the final crunch in September, October 72. He had to accept the peace treaty that Kissinger brought back from Paris. As you may remember, the Democrats were all in the anti-war movement. They were voting to have us just cut and run, turn the country over to the communists.
So is it your understanding, Steve Young, that President Nixon was not informed either about what Kissinger was doing?
Was not informed, yes. In 1971, he was not informed.
What a betrayal. So the result, just to flash forward, the result of Kissinger's separate peace negotiations, shall we say, and lack of transparency, and, well, malfeasance, I would argue, was that the South Vietnamese were actually abandoned. Partly, of course, blame goes to the Congress as well, but partly, let's be clear, it rests with the executive. And the President of the United States wasn't aware of what was being done in his name by his Secretary of State at the time.
Until it was too late. And then he had to accept these terms. So what happens is the Americans and the South Vietnamese have defeated the Viet Cong, the southern component of they've defeated the insurgency. What remains is an invasion.
The old hard power guys.
The old hard power guys. Hanoi comes south, I think, with every division they have into South Vietnam. They attack in three places. I mean, this is German Wehrmacht stuff, right? And the South Vietnamese, with support from American air power, hold them off. Now, I wouldn't say, I mean, I have so many South Vietnamese friends, and I admire so many of them. I mean, I wouldn't say they were the greatest fighting force in the history of the world, but they held off the North Vietnamese, right? And they stabilized the situation.
With American air power, though.
With American air power. When, but I don't know, I think it was five or something North Vietnamese divisions then remain inside South Vietnam. There are more in Laos, and Hanoi waits a decent interval, a couple of years. And then in early 75, they launch a probing attack. They send three of their divisions. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a couple of hundred guerrillas out there. We're talking about divisions supported by tanks and artillery against, I think, about two regiments, which is like, you know, like a tiny force of Vietnamese in a town called Phuc Long. The first one was Phuc Long. This was a test of President Gerald Ford. The issue was whether Ford would send the B-52s. Ford, who wants to get out of this thing, the anti-war movement has kind of convinced Americans that the war was really a bad idea. Ford does not send the B-52s, and Lê Duẩn in Hanoi says, that's it. The Americans are not coming back. Game on. And then Thieu makes some major mistakes under panic because he knows he's been abandoned. And he's got like 700,000 in his army, but he strings them out like in a line, one guy standing next to each other. So all the communists have to do is at any particular given point of attack, they overwhelm that particular piece of the line. They find the weak link in the chain, and they break it, and they roll it up.
So just again, to bring this to a close, Steve Young, what you've described is a successful counterinsurgency operation, CORDS, that accomplished its purpose of pacifying South Vietnam, only to be undermined and ultimately destroyed along with the country by betrayal at the highest levels of the U.S. government on the one hand, and some incompetence on the part of an overwhelmed and abandoned South Vietnamese military and political leadership. And the net effect of this was, of course, a defeat for not just the South Vietnamese, but for the Americans, the United States, that continues to cast a pall over our country, over our foreign policy, over our military leadership and initiatives, that is quite extraordinary. And Steve, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to get into the lessons of all of this for what we have been doing thus far in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and more to the point, you know, what we should understand about tomorrow's insurgencies and enemies as well. That and much more with Steve Young, the Global Executive Director of the Co-Roundtable for Moral Capitalism, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the fourth and final installment of this very special, very important, very timely conversation with the author of an important book entitled The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, CORDS in the Villages of Vietnam, 1967 to 1972. His name is Stephen Young. He is also the Global Executive Director of the Co-Roundtable for Moral Capitalism. Steve, having now carefully examined the experience you had with the Civil Operations Rural Development Support Initiative in Vietnam, and seeing firsthand what it was capable of accomplishing, it must be extraordinarily painful to you to see what we have done at unbelievable expense, both in dollars, but more importantly, in terms of lives of our servicemen and women in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. Is it your view that CORDS or something like it could have made a difference on the ground there, even though I think critics would point out, well, there isn't that shared value thing that was so important, as you said, in South Vietnam?
Oh, Well, absolutely. If we had used the CORDS program, we would have prevailed both in Iraq and Afghanistan within, let's say, 5 or 6 years max. Because CORDS, when we started CORDS in 67, by 72, we had defeated the insurgency, but we never applied CORDS. Yeah, we had sort of provincial reconnaissance teams here and there, which were supposed to be CORDS. They missed out on the basic proposition that the people are the frontline troops. And that means in Iraq, we never really focused in on the Sunni-Shia rivalry soon enough. It meant in Afghanistan, we didn't really work with tribes and local communities and decentralized power. In both Iraq and Afghanistan, we had kinetic power operating out of bases and main cities, a top-down government sort of secreted away in a capital and sending its agents out to the countryside. We never mobilized the people. The exception was sort of the Sunni awakening in Iraq, which was when the Sunni sheikhs came to us. And fortunately, we had some people like General John Allen, a Marine general, and our H.R. McMaster and some others who suddenly realized that these sheikhs were bringing over the people to work with us, to fight with us. So they then applied associative power techniques on an ad hoc basis in a couple of provinces. We missed out because we did not apply the CORD strategy.
But just speak to that question that I put a moment ago. In Afghanistan, let's say, just as an example, when you look at those Afghan tribes, they seem to feel as though they have much more in common with the Taliban than they did with either the so-called central government or certainly the infidel West. Could you have put together CORDS in the absence of that kind of affinity?
Sure. Because first of all, another thing we didn't talk about, Frank, is CORDS is also adopts the principle of a single command. Military and civilian officials work together in a single command effort. That's one. We never did that in either place. The civilians were always sort of shoved over to the side. The second point is the decentralization of power. The third point in Afghanistan is you have, you know, the basic structures, I understand it, behind the Taliban are the Pashtun people. So you focus on the Pashtun and their values, and they have something called Pashtun Wali, which is the code of the Pashtun people from time immemorial. It doesn't take a genius to figure out, you go into Pashtun Wali and you find the various motivational principles and things which can be turned against the Taliban, whose vision of Islam is pretty fundamentalist, strict, intolerant, and a lot of people don't like it. But if you have to choose between, you know, Taliban, who are your own kind of people, and a Muslim religion, which is your religion, and these Americans who are going to come in and leave you victim of, you know, vulnerable to the Taliban, who are you going to choose?
Not even a close call. Okay, so let's switch gears, Stephen Young, to really sort of the crux of this whole conversation, which is, are there lessons to be learned, not only from what we didn't do in Afghanistan and Iraq, and what we did do successfully in Vietnam, but as it might bear on the conflicts that are at the horizon, not even over it anymore, but perhaps heading our way rather fast, specifically with China and possibly with Russia?
Well, I think they're great lessons. If you apply this notion of associative power and you put on your radar screen, you look on the horizon, or who are our friends and our potential allies? What can they bring to the table? What can we bring to the table? The two big questions that I see are Russia and China. And the question is, the associative power in both countries is the people themselves. It's the Chinese people themselves. It's the Russian people themselves. Now, is there a set of ways we could work directly with the Chinese people and the Russian people, frankly, over the heads of the governments and the party, to say we have a fundamental joint interest in a peaceful world? And in China, what we would have to say is that your ancient notion of ruling all under heaven, what the Chinese call Tianxia, is kind of an old-fashioned notion, and we don't need that. And in Russia, the deep cultural driver is this notion of the Third Rome, that the Russian people were picked by God to kind of save the world for Christianity. And that's always been used in this relationship between the Tsar on one side and the Church on the other, which Putin is quite intentionally bringing back. If we could reach out not through American soft power, but through something else, to go to the Russian people and say, look, you're fine people. We like you. Let's do this. You don't need to take over the Ukraine. You don't need to do this. You don't need to destroy Syria. That's the kind of overall strategic concept I would recommend.
But is it the case that this would need to be accompanied not just by the use of various means of communications directly with the people of China or the people of Russia? And that's probably a whole other show of how do we do that effectively and competently. We certainly aren't at the moment, I don't think. But that you need a presence on the ground. Isn't that one of the lessons of CORDS, is that it took that kind of commitment on our part, as well as in direct engagement with the people that you were trying to nurture, encourage, equip, train, and so on? And could that be done from outside the country, which would seem necessary under present circumstances?
Yeah, the situation in Russia and China is not an insurgency. Vietnam, we were facing an insurgency. We had to partner with the defeat. So you can't just take a CORDS model and say, drop it into our embassy in China. What you have to do first is think strategically. What could we do in China which would be the same thing? Well, you've got business people, you've got student exchange programs, there are a whole range of things we could do in China with Chinese, which would have an impact on the way the Chinese see themselves. Now, the other thing, however, in both these cases, we're talking a longer-term thing. I mean, we're talking an effort which is probably, a decade to 15 years in length. I mean, you're not going to turn this thing around very easily in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and you know, going back to something you alluded to there a moment ago, the fact that we don't have a cohort of people being trained in Chinese and Russian language. I mean, the Russian, the old days, as you know, we did, but not so much for 20 years or so now. And Chinese, you know, there are a lot of people studying Chinese, I'm sure, but, you know, not in the kind of concerted way. And in a way, what this speaks to me about, Steve Young, is that we don't have a sort of national security mindedness in our public policy, or public for that matter, as we have in the past and as we need to have to develop such skill sets to bring to bear such capabilities. And that would seem to me to be ultimately the showstopper for anything remotely like CORDS.
You're absolutely right, Frank. You're absolutely right on that. And so one of the things you sort of play around with is we need a new department, you know, not a State Department and not a Department of Defense, but we need sort of a Department of National Security, which integrates all these things and has a long-term plan for how we make sure the world order is protective of us and our values.
Yeah. Well, I must tell you, I'm big on moral capitalism, but I'm not so big on big government. So that sounds to me like a formula for more of it. But the National Security Council or some kind of planning staff elsewhere certainly seems to me to be in order for a whole host of reasons, but not least of which is trying to learn the lessons of the past, what's worked and what we haven't been doing effectively. And Stephen Young, I hope that you're going to be one of those who will inform such an analysis right quick. We need it, needless to say. Thank you, sir, for the work that you're doing at the CO Roundtable and also for this important book. And I just want to commend it once again to our audience. It is hard to overstate the importance of this idea of associative power. Check it out, The Theory and Practice of Associative Power, CORDS in the Villages of Vietnam, 1967 to 1972. Come back to us again soon, sir, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.